We're going to talk about judgment. That's the one thing about the prophets, especially the major prophets. Major prophets meaning the prophets who wrote long, long books. Is that they go through these series of judgments where God speaks to Israel about the things that are going to happen to surrounding nations. Also things that are going to happen to Israel. And sometimes you're reading this stuff, and in this poetic fashion, God paints pretty grisly pictures for these people. And there's a reason for this, though I think I'm probably with you on this, in that when I read through the judgments, I think my wife's going through the one-year Bible. She says she's going to the last parts of Jeremiah. You know those last four or five chapters of Jeremiah? It's like, these are long chapters. And it's God just saying he's going to take care of these people and these people and these people. And it's not the funnest stuff to read. We're going to talk about the judgments on Assyria, Philistia, and Moab tonight. Now, understanding something about these groups of people, that aside from their incessant attacks on God's people, they lived lives that were contrary to God's perfect law. Numbers 1 and 2. God says, you have no other gods before me. Well, they had plenty of gods. They were polytheistic. All of these countries, all of these nations, they had several gods, different gods for different things. And so they did not know the true God, nor did they care to know the true God, and we'll learn this later as we get going tonight. But also, commandment number 2, don't carve stuff and bow down to it. Which, that's what these people were big into. So understand, they didn't want to know the true God. They worshiped the stars, the moon, the sky, the rivers, the nature. They worshiped all those things. And then they would cut down the trees they worshiped and carve them up and put eyes and a nose on them and stuff. And attribute power to them. These were fools who, when they would do these things, it did not help them, did not help their lives. Because certainly they were violent, violent people. So, keeping that in mind with all this judgment. Now, we looked at chapter 14 last week and saw Babylon's judgment, and Isaiah spoke of the king of Babylon and then kind of morphed into this Satan thing. And certainly, every king who goes on these, who are full of tyranny, certainly their king is Satan. And so, God shows us through chapter 14 who Satan is, how Satan is, and how he gets in the lives of such kings as Babylon and even the king of Assyria and Philistia and all these things. And just like the wicked kings of today, we know that Satan is really the one behind all of that. So we're going to look at Assyria first, verses 24 through 27. Now, just to get an idea of where Assyria comes from, I thought this would be fun. The Assyrians, the first mention of Assyria is in Genesis chapter 10. And we read of a guy by the name of Nimrod, who was the man who built several cities, one of them being Nineveh in Assyria. And we know that Nineveh was a huge, wicked city. These were Assyrians. And so you get the idea that Nimrod was the beginning of all of Assyria, but you also get an idea from some commentators that Assyria is from Shem, whose one kid was named Asher, and so they say that Asher is a form of the word Assyria and all of that. And so I don't know. I really don't know. All I know is that there is a guy named Nimrod who was a mighty hunter before God, and he went into Assyria and he made a bunch of cities, and Assyria has been wicked ever since. Now, Nimrod was not from Shem. He was from Ham. And so that would be Shem's brother. Now, we don't see the Assyrians again after Genesis. We don't see them again until 2 Kings chapter 15 when they begin to come against Israel. And it was during Uzziah's reign. But then we see that they are defeated, and we'll see that in Isaiah chapter 37 during Hezekiah's reign. So that's all we really know about Assyria as far as the Bible is concerned. You can read a lot of secular history about these guys, and they were brutal. So let's look at it. Verse 24, the Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, this is verse 24 of chapter 14 of Isaiah, by the way. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so it shall come to pass, and as I have purposed, so it shall stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and on my mountains tread him underfoot. Then his yoke shall be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the purpose that is purposed against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has purposed, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out, and who will turn it back? Yeah, who's going to stop God? Think about so many different people who have tried to stop God. My favorite being King Herod, Herod the Great, who when he heard that the king of the Jews was to be born in Bethlehem, he went and had all the babies killed, trying to stop God. And I don't know any way else to say this, but I just can't think of anything stupider than trying to stop God. We learn in Exodus that when God is performing the plagues on Egypt, that every time he performed a plague, Pharaoh's magicians, well, the first few plagues, not all of them, after a while they couldn't do it anymore, but the first few plagues, Pharaoh's magicians were trying to prove that it was no big deal by even making the plague worse. For instance, God sent frogs all over the land, and the magicians said, well, we can do that, and they made more frogs. But the one thing the magicians could not do was to remove the frogs. Nobody could undo what God had begun. Nobody can stop God. And it is amazing to me how many people over the course of history who have tried. It's just not going to work. Look at verse 25 as it says, I'll break the Assyrian in my land. Well, that land happens to be at that time when we get into Isaiah chapter 36 and we see the dirty letters sent to Hezekiah, and he lays the letter before God, and then God sends an angel in Isaiah chapter 37 and destroys 185,000 Assyrians one morning as they were all encamped around Jerusalem in the hills surrounding Jerusalem. And so we see that verse 25 was fulfilled in that. On my mountains, tread them underfoot. And it was a done deal. And so, verse 26 is interesting. It says, this is the purpose that is purposed against the whole earth. Now, it could be that God is speaking to Israel and as Israel sees it, as the whole earth as they knew it. And as the Assyrians were the ones that were in charge of all things, and it would be the Babylonians then, and then it would be the Medes and the Persians and such, and as far as the time Jesus was here, the Romans were the whole world. This was it. They were the rulers of the world as they knew it. And we're going to see that there's some other nations here that are going to get judged, so it could be that that's what God was talking about here. But I believe that there is also a quick glimpse here of the very end of all things. And the fact is that this purpose will be served against the whole earth. God is going to judge the whole world. Revelation 3:10, Jesus speaking to the church at Philadelphia, says, "The hour you're going to keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world." And so this could be a little glimpse into that. Maybe, maybe not. I'm okay either way. But now let's go to, verse 28. This is the burden which came in the year that King Ahaz died. Ah, this is the end of Ahaz's reign now. Now, dependent upon your sources, boy, you can sure get a widespread of dates when this was. Some say 715 B.C. The Easton Bible Dictionary says it was 724 B.C., and we'll call it that. But right then is when Hezekiah takes the throne, and now, and from that point on, really all the fun begins, because Hezekiah is a righteous king. And he cleans up the temple, he cleans up Judah, he cleans up all of these things. And as a result of that, that's when Assyria comes really bearing down on him. But God rescues him. But we'll get into Hezekiah as we get on with the book. But now, Philistia. Philistia means wanderer or foreigner. Can't really trace their origins. It's like they've always just been there. I think about that, how the Philistines are such a picture of our flesh. Don't know where it came from, but it's always been there. Always after us. Always fighting us. And man, sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. And we know that the land of the Philistines is southwest of the region of Judea. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. These are cities of the Philistines. And even today, still fighting over Gaza. And that's something, it hasn't stopped. As one commentator put it, from Philistia, the name of the land of the Philistines came to be extended to the whole of Palestine. That's where we get the word Palestine. By the way, this burden, verse 28, is the burden which came. Burden is figurative for an utterance or prophecy. But literally, it means burden. You know, it's a burden, carrying something, something heavy. Or in the Webster's Dictionary, it says, that which is borne with labor or difficulty, that which is grievous, wearisome, or oppressive. These prophecies to these prophets, through these prophets, they were never empty, detached words just coming to his mind. But they weighed heavy on his heart. They weighed heavy on his mind. These were deep passions in Isaiah. Pain. There's pain in the heart of every prophet. Because when you think about being a prophet, you're speaking the mind of God. And for every time you are brokenhearted over hurting people, every time you're brokenhearted over sinning people, every time you're brokenhearted when people lose their lives, that's the heart of God in you. Because God is brokenhearted. And if you don't believe God is brokenhearted, go to Luke chapter 19 and see him coming down there on the donkey. And he looked out over all of Jerusalem and he wept. Because he could see 40 years into their future and see them getting destroyed because they had turned from him. It killed him. It absolutely kills him. And so here is Isaiah with this burden. A burden for the Philistines. These rotten people. Well, let's read it. Do not rejoice, all you of Philistia, because the rod that struck you is broken. For out of the serpent's roots will come forth a viper, and its offspring will be a fiery flying serpent. You know what? You guys got some relief right now, but what's coming now is way worse than what you had before, and I'll explain that a little bit in a second. The firstborn of the poor will feed, and the needy will lie down in safety. I will kill your roots with famine, and it will slay your remnant. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, all you of Philistia are dissolved, for smoke will come from the north, and no one will be alone in his appointed times. I like the old King James in verse 29. I like when the old King James says things I don't understand. It's entertaining. It says, "Rejoice not thou, whole Palestina, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice." That's how you say it, I guess. "And his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent." You look up cockatrice and it's a poisonous viper. That's what it is. So I like what the New King James did with this verse for me. But it sure is fun reading it there. But what he's saying here, though, is just like I said, you have had a problem here, but that yoke is broken, that control that was over you, it's broken. Don't rejoice, because what's coming now is way worse than what you experienced. You see, back when King Uzziah lived, who was the grandfather of Ahaz, who we see just died here, he'd done a lot of damage to the Philistines. Check this out from 2 Chronicles chapter 26, verses 6 and 7. It says, "Now he went out and made war against the Philistines." That was Uzziah. "And broke down the wall of Gath, the wall of Jabna, the wall of Ashdod. And he built cities around Ashdod among the Philistines." God helped him against the Philistines, against the Arabians who lived in Gerbaal, and against the Meunites. Now, so we know that Uzziah was a serious sticky burr to the Philistines. But by the time Ahaz, Uzziah's grandson, became king, the Philistines had grown strong again, where they began to take some of their land back. It says in 2 Chronicles 28:18, "The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the lowland of the south of Judah and had taken Beth Shemesh, Ajalon, Gideroth, Soko with its villages, Timnah and its villages, and Gimzo with its villages, and they dwelt there." And so they had strengthened themselves again, but now God is speaking to them and saying, you know what, you might feel pretty good because you're out from under the yoke of Uzziah, but what's coming, it's going to be way worse. So that's what he's saying. Look at verse 30. I believe that this, the firstborn of the poor and the needy, those, I believe he's speaking of Israel, who were in bad shape, but God is saying that they are going to be cared for while you guys are destroyed. And so that's that, you people of Philistia. In verse 32, "What will they answer the messengers of the nation? That the Lord has founded Zion, and the poor of his people shall take refuge in it." God ultimately proves himself to be God and proves that he has chosen Israel. He continually proves this over and over again. God chose Israel. God is in control. And what is amazing to me is how often people just continue to reject it and keep trying to fight against him, trying to change his plan, I don't know what they're doing. I can't help but, you know, with this verse, remember what I just taught down in Peru. In Numbers chapter 16, there was a rebellion problem. A guy by the name of Korah stood up against Moses, and he stood up with, he had 250 people on his side, and then pretty soon they got all of the congregation on Korah's side, and they're coming against Moses. And then Moses goes to God and says, "God, I got a problem here." And God tells him to have them all stand out there, and then Moses tells him, "Okay, if these guys are in charge, then let them die normal deaths like everybody. But if I'm in charge and they're not of God, then let the earth open up and swallow them right now." And they all went down there and everybody ran, you know. God had said in chapter 16 of Numbers that he was going to convince the people by this. You know, I'll just convince the people. They'll be sure now what the whole thing is. Well, the next day, people came to Moses and said, "You killed God's people." And I think, well, wait a minute. I thought God did this to prove his point that he had chosen Moses. And there wouldn't be any doubt in anybody's mind. Well, anybody that's willing to use their brains. But the fact is, there are so many people who are not at all interested in the most clear facts. And such was the case with those in the children of Israel wandering through the wilderness. Just amazing to me. So God does so many things to prove who he is, to prove that he's right. The proof is always there. And if we don't believe, that is way not God's fault. He has made it clear on countless occasions. And so, verse 1 of chapter 15, the burden against Moab. Okay, we've talked about Assyria being judged, Philistia being judged, and now we're going to look at Moab being judged. Again, the burden against Moab. See that word burden again. Moab, where do these guys come from? Some of you may already know this. The Moabites started very strangely in chapter 19 of Genesis. When God delivered Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah before he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot's daughters and his wife came out with him, and they came running out, and his wife turned around and she kind of missed Sodom and Gomorrah, and then she turned into a big lump of salt. She turned into the biggest, grossest salt lick you ever saw. And then Lot and his daughters ended up in a cave and hiding out, when his daughters then started flipping out saying, well, isn't this great? We're not going to be able to carry on our dad's name. We're not going to be able to find husbands for ourselves. What are we going to do? This is so gross. They got dad drunk. They got him so drunk that he didn't know what was going on. He was obviously a blackout drinker because they got him drunk and then had sexual relations with him. Two nights in a row, so both of them could be impregnated by their father. And so they had children, Moab and Ammon, which would be the Moabites and the Ammonites. These two children would then, you know, grow into these nations that would continually be a scourge to Israel and be a problem with Israel. In fact, it was in Numbers chapters 22 through 25 when we meet a guy by the name of Balaam, you know, the guy who fights and argues with donkeys. He was, the children of Israel were going to just go through Moab because they were told in Deuteronomy chapter 2 verse 9, God told them, don't harass Moab. Well, why not harass Moab? Because, this is amazing, because Moab was Lot's kid. God still favored Lot through all of this. Now, Moab wouldn't have the best time in the way they're going to be judged here. But God told Israel, no, you will not come against Moab. And that's that. So they weren't going to come against Moab. They're going to come they're going to come through the Moabite land and then into the promised land. It was a good plan. But Balak, the king of Moab, got flipped out, and he hired Balaam to try to curse the people because he was afraid of the Israelites, not knowing that, you know, the Israelites weren't going to touch him. Now, when Balaam was not allowed by God to curse the children of Israel, you know, every time Balaam opened his mouth, he said nice things instead of mean things, like he was paid to do. When it was all done, finally, Balaam just told Balak, you see in chapter 25 of Numbers, he told him, look, I can't curse them, but I bet I can get them to curse themselves, and started sending in Moabite and Midianite women. Send in the women. And that is when Israel did sin and they cursed themselves. There's a horrible plague as a result of the sexual sin that took place. But Moab had everything to do with the trouble that they saw there. In Judges chapter 3, when they do, when the children of Israel are in the land, Eglon, king of Moab, had ruled over God's people for a time. It was not until 2 Samuel chapter 8 that the Moabites became Israel's servants. But in 2 Kings chapter 3, we see they rebel. And we see that they fought the alliance of Ahab and Jehoshaphat as well. Ahab and Jehoshaphat, Ahab was the rotten king of the north, and Jehoshaphat was a good king of the south, but Jehoshaphat wasn't the brightest king of the south as he decided to get together with Ahab and fight against Moab. And of course, Ahab, if you remember that story, that was something else. Ahab said, oh good, you're going to fight with me? Yeah, I'm going to fight with you. Okay, tell you what, I'm going to disguise myself as like a regular person. I'm not going to wear any king's clothes. But can you can wear the king outfit. And of course, they were aiming for the king. But that's all another story altogether. But that was with the Moabites. So we know that Moab has a history of violence against Israel, yet their history goes all the way back to Lot and his daughters. So what does God say to them? What is this burden? Verse 1, because the burden against Moab, because in the night Ar of Moab is laid waste and destroyed, because in the night Kir of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. He has gone up to the temple in Dibon to the high places to weep. Moab will wail over Nebo and over Medeba. On all their heads will be baldness and every beard cut off. That's for mourning that they would do. In their streets, they will clothe themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses in the streets, everyone will wail, weeping bitterly. Heshbon and Elealeh will cry out. Their voice shall be heard as far as Jahaz. Therefore, the armed soldiers of Moab will cry out. His life will be burdensome to him. So we see all the strong cities will be destroyed in Moab. That would be Ar, Kir, Nebo, Medeba. Verse 2 is a little weird if you look at it in the Old King James and the NIV. It says, as far as the word temple here in verse 2, the Hebrew word is baith, which is spelled bajith in the Old King James. The word means house. That's why the New King James translates it temple, because it's an assumption that is spoken of going up to their temple to worship. Now, the NIV twists this around in a way I just don't understand. I would say the NIV, it's really easy to understand, but I don't think it's saying what it's saying here. It says Dibon goes up to its temple. Whoa. It says he's gone up to the temple and Dibon. Well, anyway, Dibon goes up to its temple, to its high places to weep. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. Every head is shaved and every beard cut off. So I'm thinking, you know, Dibon is a city, so I guess maybe the whole city of Dibon went up to the temple, and that's what the NIV is trying to get at, but I don't think that's what happened. It could have, but that's, I don't think, is what it's read here. But having said all of that, I want to give you the whole point here. The point is that Moab is crying out to their gods to no avail. Their cities are destroyed, and they're going to their places of worship where they are not getting an answer from their gods. Because their gods have no power. Since these gods were created in the minds of the people. In Jeremiah chapter 10, we find God telling his people, do not do what the pagans do. Don't go get a tree, chop it down, decorate it, put on, you know, cut it up and make it look really nice. Don't do that. He said, they think that thing can help them, but it doesn't help you. It's just an object. It cannot harm you, nor can it help you. But people attribute power to these things. I love it. When we get to Isaiah chapter 44, we can enjoy laughing with God about idolatry. He He says in chapter 44 of Isaiah, you go in the forest, cut down a tree. You use half of it to fuel your fire. The other half, you fashion it. And you set it up and you prop it up. And you say, you are my God. You have delivered me. You know, I always wondered, you know, I hope they got the right half, you know. Because, boy, if they got the wrong half and accidentally burned God to a crisp, that would be a real drag. But, you know, God is so, he's so clear in communicating the idiocy of idolatry. And how amazing it is that you can have an inanimate piece of, I mean, you could get a 2x4, right? You realize that if you carve that into the shape of a person or an animal or something, somebody will worship it. When it used to be a 2x4. I say save the carving time, just worship the 2x4. Just save it, just set it up, saying, there's my God. Yeah, it rescues me. Understand the 2x4 is only powerful if you use it to hit somebody with. That's the only power that thing has. But you see, the people of Moab, they're crying out to their idols. And they're not getting an answer. You know why? Because those are rocks and sticks. They won't answer you. But understand this, while God is clear that it is foolish to think that a piece of wood has power, or, you know, and he says that it can't harm you and it can't help you. And certainly these things are true. Paul says regarding idolatry in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 19 through 21. He says, what am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything? Rather, that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and of the table of demons. And that's why idolatry is out of the question. This is not to say that behind every carved 2x4 is a demon. But what it is saying is that if this is what you truly worship, then yes, you are worshiping demons. But the objects themselves, no, they have no power. There's nothing in them. But we do see Moab crying out to their gods, and nothing's happening. Their cities are being destroyed. In verse 5, my heart will cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee to Zoar like a 3-year-old heifer, for by the ascent of Luith, they will go up with weeping, for in the way of Horonaim, they will raise up a cry of destruction. By the way, this 3-year-old heifer, it's a strange word there that it's just, it's hard for them to understand if it's a place or they're actually talking about 3-year-old heifer, but I think it's a place. Anyway, they're going. They will raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim will be desolate, for the green grass has withered away. The grass fails, there's nothing green. Therefore, the abundance they have gained and what they have laid up, they will carry away to the brook of the willows. For the cry has gone all around the borders of Moab. It's wailing to Eglim, and it's wailing to Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon, manuscripts have it Dibon, and that's what, you know, they think that there's a scribal error, perhaps, on Dimon, will be full of blood, because I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon him who escapes from Moab and on the remnant of the land. And so those who try to escape, they're just going to get it from lions. Those who try to get away, they're going to run into famine. They're going to run into every trouble there could possibly be. But I am still, well, this goes with the burden against Moab. Look at the first part in verse 5. My heart will cry out for Moab. God is not happy about this. God does not squish people the way we swat flies. Sometimes we do think, because this can be our attitude, we get so stinking tired of those people. Well, God ought to just blow them out of the water. That's what God ought to do. They get what they deserve. God never has that attitude. Remember, God created these people and he loves them. He loves the Assyrians. He loves the Babylonians. He loves the Philistines. He loves the Moabites. And it breaks his heart. His heart cries over this stuff. Ezekiel 33:11 says, "As I live, says the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn from your evil ways. For why should you die, O house of Israel?" You know what? I'm teaching band up there at Three Rivers. Some of them kids, them are Moabites is what they are, some of them kids. They are there to disrupt. They are there not to learn. They are there for no other reason than to disobey and be a pain in the neck. What does that do for my class? It ruins it. But I will tell you this, those kids are the ones I hurt over because I know they're getting a bum rap at home. I know these kids are not being disciplined, not being loved. They're being tossed all over the place by their parents. They're not cared about. I'd tell a student, I said, "You know what? You need to go back to class." And I'm not happy about that. I'm never happy when a student has to go back to class. But I will tell you this, when the student goes back to class, that my entire class does very well. You got to do what you got to do sometimes with these kids. God looks on the whole world and he sees people that are not here for anything good. They have chosen evil. They have chosen rebellion. And with their rebellion, what good could they ever do except to take others down with them in that rebellion? And God has a burden on his heart. God's heart cries out over Moab. God's heart cries out over, and think about the Muslims. I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. So don't ever think that God flippantly just goes about squashing. But he gives warning, 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 warning. And then he finally does what he needs to do. And not to his delight. We must be brokenhearted like God regarding judgment. In chapter 16, he keeps a going. "Send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness to the mount of the daughter of Zion, for it shall be as a wandering bird thrown out of the nest, so shall be the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon." The Arnon is the river that borders Moab. And so they're all going to be lost, but the answer here that God is giving them is, it says, to send a lamb to the ruler of the land. What is what? Well, the NIV clears it up this time. "Send lambs as tribute to the ruler of the land from Selah across the desert to the mount of the daughter of Zion." God is telling them, place yourself under tribute to Israel. Place yourself under the rule of Jerusalem. Run to them for help. Now, there was a time that Moab had actually paid tribute to Jerusalem. 2 Kings chapter 3, verses 4 and 5 says, "Now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel." So there was a time when Ahab finally died that he said, "But I'm going to do that anymore." And now here God's telling him, you know what? You better start sending lambs back to my people. That would have to be the answer. You see, because when Jerusalem ran the show for you, all was well. But now, all is not well. And I will tell you, this is a great picture for those who have turned from God. Turn back. Place yourselves under the influence of Jesus Christ again if you want to live. I started thinking, is that those who walk away from the Lord, the answer is to again place themselves under tribute to God, to go serve God again, because when you are not serving God, you are serving sin. We need to be placed under the influence of the Lord and get out from under the influence of sin. Now, Selah, this is great. File this away for just a second because I'm going to come back to it in a little second. Selah means rock. And it's the same as Petra. And this Selah in the wilderness is what we call Petra today, which means rock as well. So where Moab is running to is that ancient city, Petra. You say, okay, so, well, I don't know. Let's keep reading. Verse 3. "Take counsel, execute judgment, make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. Hide the outcast, do not betray him who escapes. Let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. In mercy, the throne will be established, and one will sit on it in truth, in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness." I want you to know that between verses 3 and 5, if you really want to make sense of this, it's just, I don't think it's completely possible. Now, some people are trying to make sense of this by changing some of the meaning, because verse 3 looks to me like Isaiah is addressing Israel. Like he's telling Israel, you know, hey, don't betray him who escapes. Hide the outcast. In other words, people are going to come from Moab, and I want you to take them in. Except when you get to verse 4, then you go, oh, wait a minute, let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. So, oh, okay, so wait a minute. God just told them in verse 1 to put themselves under Judah, under Jerusalem, under Israel. And so it would make sense that verse 3 is him saying, okay, Israel, you take them in. But then it just changes. Let my outcasts dwell with you. Oh my, what outcasts? Those of Israel. Okay, so I know you follow me for a little bit down this little crooked path, because I want to straighten this out a little bit, I think. And you can take or leave this. But I like it. It's clear that in verse 4 that Moab is instructed to shelter Israel. And then in verse 5 we see that clear messianic prophecy. Now, I know we look through a glass dimly and we don't see a lot of these prophecies perfectly clear. And there's certainly some passages of scripture that aren't going to be perfectly clear until the day it happens, and we'll go, oh, wow! And we'll see it so clearly with no problem. So here is my theory. I believe that suddenly the focus has gone all the way into the tribulation period. Because we're saying there in verse 4, let my outcasts dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them. But where is Moab here? They're in Selah. They're in Petra. Revelation chapter 12, verse 14 says, but the woman, by the way, if you read all of chapter 12 of Revelation, you can see very clearly that that woman is Israel. Israel was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. Where Israel will be hidden away and protected during the wrath of God, the tribulation period. And a lot of people believe that that place that they are taken to would have to be Petra. You've seen pictures of that place and all of that. It's because it's situated between in the wilderness, big walls of cliffs all around you, and it's just a tough place to get to. But I will say this, as I said when I was teaching Revelation, it makes sense to us that it would be a place like Petra that they would be brought to. But understand that God can protect them anywhere they are. They don't need a really nifty place to hide out. God can protect them anywhere. He can bring them to Paris, for heaven's sake, and protect them there. But the only way, and you may have some ideas, and I'm completely open to them, but the only way I can see this right now as I'm reading this is just that Isaiah is speaking of the second coming of Christ, because he does come judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness. In verse 5 there. That's how Jesus comes the second time. And we know that Israel will be hidden away somewhere. And I just find it interesting here that the language here is, hey, Moab, hide these guys. But where is Moab here? They're in the rock city of Petra. Just interesting stuff. I made all that up myself, by the way. I did. I was excited about it, too. But because that is quite frankly the only way I can make sense out of these verses and putting them all together as a whole. And others have said other things that don't make sense to me. And it's like I said, though, we look through a glass dimly. And we'll know for sure when the time comes. Verse 6. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. Therefore, Moab shall wail for Moab. They'll be feeling sorry for themselves. Everyone shall wail for the foundations of Kir Hareseth. You shall mourn. Surely they are stricken. For the fields of Heshbon languish and the vine of Sibma. The lords of the nations have broken down his choice plants, which have reached to Jazer and wandered through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. All this judgment is from, you see in verse 6, the pride. Pride of Moab. It is always pride. Pride is the great destroyer in this world. It was Satan's destroyer. That was his bag. It was pride. And so he's cast out for his pride. It's the destroyer of every great ruler that has ever lived. It's the destroyer of every rich athlete. It is the destroyer of, every little guy. Anybody who's filled with pride is in trouble because God will not stand for it. God will not stand for pride. One commentator says this: whenever pride is not broken by humility, it will have to be broken by justice. Good word. Therefore, I will bewail the vine of Sibma with the weeping of Jazer. And here he is, just crying again over this. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Eleale, for battle cries have fallen over your summer fruits and your harvest. Gladness is taken away and joy from the plentiful field. In the vineyards there will be no singing, nor will there be shouting. No treaders will tread out wine in the presses. I have made their shouting cease. Therefore my heart shall resound like a harp for Moab, and my inner being for Kir Hareth. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he will come to a sanctuary to pray, but he will not prevail. So God is still not thrilled about their destruction. He weeps over it. And certainly neither is Isaiah. He's not excited about it either. He has the heart of God. Yet in all of this, you see, Moab will pray to no avail, because he goes to his sanctuary to pray. Still clamoring after the abominations, still clamoring after lies, still holding on to whatever lie he can come up with. I mean, everything's falling apart, and he's still heading to the horoscope for answers instead of going to the God of Israel. No matter how sincere one's devotion is to a false god, it's still false. He's still wrong. Sincerity counts for nothing. Let me say it again. Sincerity counts for nothing, because you can be sincerely wrong. I mean, if I sincerely believe that a boat with holes in it is not going to sink, my sincerity will not stop the boat from sinking. And Moab sincerely went to their gods, and they were still carved up 2x4s. That's all they were. This is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hired man, the glory of Moab will be despised with all that great multitude, and the remnant will be very small and feeble. Now, we know that we can't find any Moabites today, so we know they're gone now, but trying to pinpoint the exact time, we see that it was Ahaz had just died. We don't know how much writing he did after that, if it was years or weeks or a day or what. But it is a good guess to say that this was the beginning of Hezekiah's reign. And commentators suggest that the Assyrians were used 3 years later in the destruction of Moab. It says in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 9, says, it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And the commentators suggest, because you have to read into it to get this, that before it got to Samaria, it had to go through Moab, and that Assyria then took out Moab at that time. But that's just speculation. We don't know exactly for sure how Moab got destroyed, but they did. But God told Israel so that they would believe he's God. God kept telling Israel all these things, and certainly all these things would happen. We don't know if the prophecies ever reached Moab, but it could be. You know, God didn't keep things completely secret from these people, as God sent Jonah to Nineveh, right? Nineveh was an Assyrian city. And God gave them a timeline as well. Hey, you got 40 days. 40 days and Nineveh's overthrown. But you see, God will relent if we relent. And Nineveh then repented in sackcloth and ashes, and then God did not destroy Nineveh. I am guessing that it's God's style that Moab did get a hold of these prophecies. Not so that they could live in fear for 3 years waiting for the shoe to drop, but that maybe they would turn from their sins so that they could have life. The prophecies of the end times in the Bible are there for everybody to see, not just Christians. And the end times are going to happen when they are going to happen. But these things are written so that anybody who reads these things can say, wow, I don't want to be a part of those who are lost for eternity. It gives the whole world a chance to turn to the Lord. So we can thank God with all our hearts for His prophecies. And hey, gang, let's let Fort Bragg know. Father, thank you for your word. And I pray, Lord, that we would understand your heart in all your judgment. I pray that we would not be happy when anybody is judged. Lord, we should have been judged. Lord, I pray that you will help us to walk with you. Help us to share your love, your power, and Lord, that we would even share your judgment with people so that they understand. We thank you that you sent your Son to take your judgment on our behalf. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Lord, we know we don't have much time left. So help us. Help us to spread these prophecies all over the place. Thank you, Lord. We love you and pray in Jesus' name. Amen.